This is the legendary Tom DeFalco, and you're listening to Amazing Spider Talk. Tell all your friends, because these guys are going to pay me a buck every time a new listener tunes in.
Welcome to the Amazing Spider Talk. My name is Dan Gavazdin, and I'm the editor of SuperiorSpiderTalk.com. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Spider Talk and Their Amazing Friends. I'm alone this time, but I hope you enjoy this podcast and the conversation between one fan, that's me, and a famous Spider-Man creator. For this episode, we'll be talking to the legendary Tom DeFalco. This is the second time that we've had Tom on the show, and we're excited to have him back to talk about his upcoming Spider-Man books and Marvel's 75th anniversary. Tom worked at Marvel Comics for over 20 years. During that time, he was one of the most popular writers of Amazing Spider-Man. Eventually, Tom became the editor-in-chief of Marvel for 7 years, making him one of the longest-serving individuals to have that title. Tom also co-created Spider-Girl and wrote over 100 issues of the series, making it Marvel's longest-running female-led superhero title. I had a great time talking to Tom, but we had some slight audio problems that I only realized once I listened back to the show. I think the interview is still really great despite these issues, and as it is an extra episode, I figure that you all would still probably want to hear it anyway. So I hope you enjoy the show, and if this is the first time you're listening, know that I take sound quality as a matter of pride, so this is a rare example where the sound might not be perfect. Nevertheless, I hope you all enjoy my interview with the legendary Tom DeFalco.
Spider-Man and his amazing friends. Iceman and Firestar.
Well, hi, everybody. This is Dan Gavazdin here for Superior Spider Talk. And I'm talking today with the legendary Tom DeFalco. So welcome to the show, Tom.
Thanks for inviting me.
Awesome. Well, it's great to have you. So, we've talked to you before about the history of, like, your story with the Hobgoblin and all these other books that you've written. And today I'd like to kind of talk to you about your history with Marvel. But before we even get there, I wanted to ask you about your history with comics. You know, can you remember picking up your first comic? And, like, do you remember, like, did you feel compelled by this thing? Or what was your history with comic books?
You know, my history with comics, goes back to the daily and Sunday newspaper scripts. We got a couple of Sunday papers every Sunday, and I was fascinated by the comics. My favorites were things like, you know, the Phantom, you know, Mandrake the Magician, mm-hmm. Dick Tracy. Eventually I fell in love with Pogo. And I'm still in love with Pogo, On Stage by Leonard Starr, and I just love, the comic medium. My first comic book, I seem to remember that I was at some sort of family gathering, and one of my cousins, my cousin John, who lives in Boston, he was older than I was, and he said, "Hey, I have something to show you." And he handed me either a Batman comic book or a detective comic book. You know, all I remember was the Batman, logo at that time.
Yeah.
It had Batman, as part of the logo and stuff. And I remember reading this and going through it, and it scared the heck out of me. Batman just struck me as such a creepy character, and I was kind of taken aback with that. But I was also, kind of intrigued by the idea of the comics, you know, in this handy little booklet.
Yeah.
Up until then, what I had done is, you know, I cut out newspaper strips and I put them together in my own book. So I'd been making comic books myself for
there
a while.
You go.
And then I started to look around and discover that you could actually buy these things, comic books, you know, at the local store. And I don't know how old I was, 7, 8, 9, somewhere around there, maybe younger, maybe older. I must have been younger because, you know, because years later when I was at the ripe old age of 11, I was starting to lose interest in comics. You know, they just weren't getting to me anymore. And then one day, it was a wintry day. I went to the store to, you know, just look at the comic book rack. And as I'm flipping around the rack, they used to have these big spinner racks. I noticed this thing called Fantastic Four, and they had the same character on both covers, the Human Torch. When I first saw the title Fantastic Four, I just assumed it meant four stories in the comic book. But now I remember it was issues 3 and 4, and I decided to pick those two comic books up. Went home, read them together, and my mind was blown, as they used to say in those days.
Yeah.
You know, these were comic books unlike anything I had read before. And, you know, from that point on, I was a hardcore Marvel fan.
So what was it about those particular comics that, like, drew you more than, like, say, Batman or anything you'd read up to that point?
Well, these were much more character-oriented, and the characters didn't always get along. They were squabbling, kind of like, you know, I grew up in a family of, you know, 7 kids. You know, we were always squabbling. So, you know, it felt like home to me. You know, everybody was arguing. Everybody had their own point of view. Everybody had their own situation going on, their own problems. And they were also something that you know, really struck home to me is I used to have a problem, you know, I like Jimmy Olsen comics. But I didn't like Superman comics and you know, especially Superman comics with Lois Lane. And that was because, you know, Lois Lane would suspect that Clark Kent was Superman. And then she'd, you know, go to extraordinary lengths to prove it. And then it would be proven to her beyond the shadow of a doubt that Clark Kent was not Superman. And next issue, she forgot about that and started all over again. And I used to think, boy, she can't remember from issue to issue what happened. But in the Fantastic Four, issue 3 ended on kind of a cliffhanger. And issue 4 reflected that cliffhanger. And everything that had happened in issue 3, the characters remembered, which was something I'd never seen before in comic books. I know it sounds like a silly thing now.
Right.
Because now everybody, you know, pays attention to what happened, you know, last issue. Or a lot of people do.
And sometimes the cliffhanger is the biggest part of the issue.
Yeah. And, you know, although, you know, some comic books these days, they have a big cliffhanger. There's a villain standing on the last page. And the next issue, they don't refer to that villain, which kind of confuses me. but that's modern comics. So,
you don't happen to have those issues of Fantastic Four anymore, do you?
I recently sold them.
Oh.
You know, a boring story, but Hurricane Sandy kind of destroyed my basement
and a lot of my
old comics. And the comics that survived, I had to stack up in the garage. And the time came where winter was coming, so I had to clean the comics out of the garage in order to fit the car in there. So I had to sell a bunch of comics.
There you go. The real story of comic storage.
Yes, well, that's one of the problems that you face.
So how did you find your way to Marvel? You know, you fell in love with these particular comics. Was it did it become a dream in your head to go and work for Marvel? Or because correct me if I'm wrong, you worked for DC before Marvel?
Yeah, I worked for a bunch of companies before Marvel. When I was growing up, you know, there were two really good writers in comics, Stan Lee and, you know, Bob Kaniger over at DC. And pretty early on, I kind of realized that I wanted to be a writer. But it never occurred to me to write comics, because I figured if you weren't Stan Lee and you weren't Bob Kaniger, there really wasn't a place for you in the comics. So as I was growing up, I was thinking more along the lines of Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, doing those kind of adventure stories and stuff. As I got out of high school, got into college, you know, new writers had shown up on the scene. Roy Thomas and Denny O'Neill and, Mike Friedrich and, you know, so many other guys. I'm, you know, not remembering, you know, all of the names, but it still didn't occur to me that, you know, you could actually get a job in comics. I don't know how those guys did it. So I wasn't actually planning on it. I was thinking of maybe doing a comic strip, and writing stories. I kind of thought I'd, you know, be a weekend, you know, more of a weekend writer, which is a lot different from a writer who has to work on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after I grad, you know, while I was at college, you know, I sold, and I started to sell my writing for the first time. I sold some newspaper articles. I ended up working, you know, for a while on a newspaper, worked for a PR office, and, you know, sold a couple of short stories and blah, 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 blah. And then when I graduated, I was looking for a job. And I thought, you know, why don't I apply to some comic book companies? I figured, you know, I could work in the comic book industry until I could sell a comic strip. And I, you know, did the worst thing possible. I, you know, wrote letters, you know, with a resume and that sort of thing. A recent college graduate, you know, I had worked on a comic strip in college, and which was published, you know, in the college newspaper. And I put some samples together and blah, blah, blah. And I sent this, you know, I sent out, you know, essentially a resume to all the different comic book companies. And to, you know, to my delight, Archie Comics got back to me and, you know, invited me in for an interview. And then eventually gave me a job in their art department. My first job was to open, you know, all the mail for Dear Betty and Veronica to see if there were any quarters inside for the Archie Club. You know, and then I did some proofreading and, you know, and continued to work for Archie Comics for, I'm going to say, 7 years.
And that comic was wildly successful at the time, correct?
What, Archie Comics?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Archie was doing terrific at that time. And, you know, eventually started to sell some stories at Archie, and eventually started to, you know, cut back on the staff days and started to work there part-time. I think I, you know, towards the end there, I was working there 2 days a week on staff and, you know, the rest of the time at home. And while I was, you know, freelancing, I started to also freelance for Charlton Comics and did a, you know, bunch of titles for the Charlton group, Willie and the Chopper Bunch and Flintstones and, you know, Flintstone Kids and Scooby-Doo and, you know, a whole bunch of titles for Charlton. And then at some point, I guess I met Paul Levitz at, they used to have this thing called the Academy of Comic Book Arts and Sciences, a guild, you know, or an organization for comic book professionals. And they would invite us Archie guys there once a year when it came time to pay our dues. Otherwise, they didn't invite us to the meetings. And I think I met Paul Levitz there. And eventually, through Paul, I met Joe Orlando at DC and started to work with them on some commercial jobs, and eventually started to do some freelance work for DC. And then, you know, from, I think, you know, Paul had this weekly poker game, and he invited me to the poker game where I met a bunch of the guys, Len Wein, Marv Wolfman, Jim Shooter, and a bunch of other people. And Jim Shooter, when I met Jim Shooter, I remember reading stories about Jim Shooter when I was, you know, younger. And I just assumed that he was the daughter, excuse me, that he was the son of Jim Shooter, the writer. I didn't realize it was the same Jim Shooter because he was so young. You know, eventually I, you know, was invited to do some stuff for Marvel. And, you know, so I was freelancing for, you know, Marvel and DC and Charlton and Archie and, you know, and doing a bunch of non-comic book stuff. And, you know, at some point DC had the, I forget what they called it, but they stopped publishing a lot of titles. And around that time, Marvel offered me a couple of books. I think it was two or three titles. I don't remember at this stage. And eventually offered me an exclusive contract, writing contract. And then, you know, at some point, you know, Shooter was reorganizing the editorial department. Well, Shooter had been made editorial in chief and editor in chief, and had decided to reorganize the editorial department. And he asked me at one point if I'd like to come on staff. And at that stage, I hadn't had a full-time job in, I don't know, 5-6 years. I only had a full-time job maybe for 4 years out of college.
Oh, and to be an artist.
You know, and I said to Jim, I don't know if I can, you know, I can do that, you know, full-time job anymore. I'm so used to freelancing. I have, you know, other stuff I'm doing, non-comic book stuff that I, you know, still have to do. And and he said, well, why don't you take it on a temporary basis? Why don't you take it for this, let's say like 6 months, just until I can organize things. And I said, yeah, I could probably do it for 6 months. Jim Shooter had always been very good to me, so I really couldn't see letting him down. So I, you know, took a job for what I thought was going to be about 6 months and ended up to be closer to 20 years. that's the long story.
Well, you know, you have an amazing story, like going from, like, you know, this freelancer all the way up to editor in chief eventually. You know, I bet you couldn't even imagine that as a possibility.
Not at all.
Well, so we're a Spider-Man podcast, and so what I'm curious, like, you know, you've worked on a lot of characters over time, but I guess for the majority of it, you've worked on Spider-Man-related characters, you know, Spider-Girl and all these people. But, like, why do you think that, you know, Spider-Man is the character that you've been associated with so much? Is it, like, a love of the character or just, like, a voice that you find comfortable? Or neither?
I guess growing up, my two favorite characters were Spider-Man, you know. I don't even know if I can separate them. Spider-Man, Thor, and Captain America. You know, I just look, you know, those three characters just always got to me. I think my very favorite was Captain America. When I worked on staff with Shooter, I basically took the job. And as soon as I took the job, you know, people started to ask me, so what titles are you going to edit? And I said, yeah, I don't know. I forgot to ask. at one point, Shooter said to me, well, what do you think is the worst title Marvel is doing? And I said, probably, you know, at that time, Ghost Rider. I said, it just, he said, why don't you like it? I said, I don't know. It's like, you know, the people who do it, it's like they've never been on a motorcycle and, you know, and you got this, you know, scary image and no one's really playing up that, you know, the horror of the thing. And he said, oh, okay. So I thought, oh, man, I'm going to probably get stuck with Ghost Rider and a bunch of the, you know, crummy titles. And when I came in, he said to me, you know, he gave me, he said, I'm going to give you the Spider-Man titles. And I said, the Spider-Man titles? Don't you think you need somebody with a little bit more experience doing the Spider-Man titles? And Shooter said to me, why? It's just like Archie, except with superpowers. And I thought, yeah, you know, he's kind of right. All right, let me go in there with that attitude. And I, you know, I thought, okay, let me see. I said, and Jim, if I feel I can't do it, you know, I can come to you and you'll take the titles away, right? He says, if I feel you can't do it, I'm going to come in and take the titles away. And then the other three titles I had were, and I was the first editor, other than Stan, who had all the Spider-Man titles together.
Yeah.
Up until then, they were separated.
And there were a lot more at that time.
Well, there were just three. Amazing, Peter Parker, Spectacular Spider-Man, and Marvel Team-Up. Mm-hmm. So it's just those three. So I had those three titles, plus Ghost Rider and Micronauts and What If. And, you know, I started working on the Spider-Man titles and, you know, really enjoyed it, really enjoyed the people I was working with. I had Roger Stern on Amazing, Mark DeMatteis on Marvel Team-Up, and Bill Mantlo on Spectacular. I mean, with guys like that, how could you not love Spider-Man?
Yeah, right.
You know, and I had terrific artists on the books, and I just loved it. And then, you know, while we were on that stuff, we started to coordinate the titles for the first time, and, you know, and just, you know, we were just having a ball, and I think it showed. You know, after a couple of years, Shooter came to me and said, I need you to do something else for me. And I said, what's that? He says, well, we're going to do a children's line and blah, blah, blah. And I said, you want me to edit the children's line? Well, no, I think I'm going to get somebody else in. But I'd like you to supervise. I said, what do you mean, supervise an editor? He goes, yeah, we'll probably give you another title. I said, well, what about the Spider-Man stuff? Oh, don't worry about that. And I said, I can still edit the Spider-Man titles. He said, oh, yeah, don't worry about that. And then they made me executive editor, which at, you know, at the time I agreed to it, I really didn't know what the job was. And eventually found out it was, you know, the second idiot, you know, in chief. And then also found out that I was not going to be editing the Spider-Man titles. I was, you know, I had to give them up. And I found out that Danny Fingeroth was going to be editing the titles. You know, I became the executive editor and initially was kind of annoyed that I had to give up the Spider-Man titles. And initially got even more annoyed when I found out it was mainly an administrative job. And then I found out that Sid, they were bringing in this guy from Harvey to edit the children's titles, Sid Jacobson. And I was supposed to supervise Sid Jacobson, who probably knew 10 times more than I did easily, you know, probably close to 100 times more than I did.
Make your job easy.
Oh, man, I think I learned. You know, I used to love going in to talk to Sid because I'd walk out knowing so much more than I did walking in.
Great.
It was just a, working with Sid was just a fabulous experience. But around that time, Roger Stern was offered the Avengers, and Roger had had a wonderful time. I'm going to say Roger had a wonderful time, working with me. He probably thinks I'm, a bum, but but I'm going to put words in his mouth Roger enjoyed, the experience, and he was offered the Avengers, so he decided to give up Spider-Man. And one day, Danny Fingeroth walked into my office and said to me, Roger Stern is leaving Amazing Spider-Man. I need to get a replacement. Now, part of my job as executive editor was to keep track of all the freelancers and make suggestions if an editor needed somebody for something. So I pulled my list off the wall, and I started looking at the list, and I started throwing out names to Danny of people who I thought could do a good Spider-Man. And then I looked up, and he had this goofy expression on his face. And I said to him, why aren't you writing this stuff down? And Danny said to me, because I already know who I want to write the book. And I said to him, if you already know who you want to write the book, why are you wasting my time? and he started to laugh, and he said, because you're the one I want to write the book. And I said, I can't do Spider-Man. I said to him, I'm never going to be able to catch that voice. Only an idiot is going to follow Roger Stern, because Roger did such a great job. Whoever does it after him is going to look like a bum. And, there's no way I could follow Roger. And Danny said, I think you can do it. I think you know the character, and I'm pretty sure you can do it. And I said, I don't know. I don't know, Danny. I'm not really confident. And he said, well, I tell you what, Roger, I think he had done two plots where he didn't want to script them. He wanted to get on Avengers right away. He said, why don't you script these two issues? And if you see how you can do. And I said, all right, but if I feel I can't do it on the first one, I can quit, right? And he says, well, if I feel you can't do it on the first one, I'll fire you. Don't worry about it.
Always looking for that exit.
Always looking for the exit, because I had no confidence. So I had no confidence as an editor. I had no confidence as a writer. Now, one of those issues happened to be the issue where Spider-Man, the one issue was where Spider-Man leaves to join the Secret Wars. The second issue is where he comes back in the black costume.
Great time to get on the book.
But who knew? Who knew? That's how I started on Spider-Man.
So, why do you think that you've been, you're asked to write him so often, is it just an understanding of the voice, or, what is it that you think they keep wanting you to do it, and, because is it a personal thing for you, or, you just find it comfortable?
I don't know why anybody else asks me to do it. I guess during my run on Spider-Man, I gather now, now years later, people look at that run and say, I really enjoyed it. I really liked it. At the time, they just told me how bad I was in comparison to Roger Stern.
Tough competition.
Yeah, well, Roger Stern, I think after Stan, Roger did the best.
Yeah.
I'm very prejudiced. I'm just a Roger Stern geek. I think that, people must have liked it. And as years gone by, people keep coming back to me and asking me to do more. I started Spider-Girl, I only intended to do one Spider-Girl story. Because The title that I was assigned to was What If? So I had to come up with ideas for what if. And, you know, I had, you know, had in the back of my mind, you know, what if Peter Parker's, you know, daughter had lived? And, you know, called Ron Frenz, my unindicted co-conspirator, and said, hey, you want to do a story featuring a Spider Girl? And he goes, Spider Girl? Oh, man, can't we call her Spider Woman? I said to him, no, I don't want to use Spider Woman because that, you know, that has the stink of death on it. They've already had like three or four Spider Women. Let's not do another one. Let's come out with something new, something different. We'll call our Spider Girl. So he goes, well, what's your idea? And then we started talking and, you know, and came up with the What If issue. I think it was, I'm terrible with numbers. What If 105, this, the first Spider Girl thing. And we had a lot of fun doing it. And, you know, as we were finishing it up, Rod said, hey, do you think we can ever do another one? And I said, you know, who knows? Maybe we can do another, you know, a sequel to this somewhere along the line. But we were not planning to do a series.
Yeah, right.
You know, and as for other Spider-Man stuff, you know, I don't know why people ask me to do it. You know, I know this is a website devoted to Spider-Man and everything else. But you know, if I never had to write another Spider-Man story, I think my life could be complete. I don't have to do anymore. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. You've done plenty.
Yeah. If somebody asks me and it's, you know, and the conditions are right, you know, I'd be happy to do it, but it's not like I'm walking around, you know, thinking about, you know, my next Spider-Man story.
And a little greater, walk a little prouder, be an innovator, laugh a little louder, go forever greater, we can show you how to, and when will you be then? You'll belong, you'll belong, you'll belong, you'll belong to the Merry Marble Marching Society.
This seemed like the perfect place to take a break in the show to remind you listeners about the Friendly Neighborhood Spider Talk Members Club. If you'd like to become a member of the Friendly Neighborhood Spider Talk Members Club and help support our show, please go to my site and click on the giant button that reads Friendly Neighborhood Spider Talk Members Club. Why did we name it that? You know, Marvel just turned 75 years old, and, you know, like they're apt to do, they're putting on a big show about it. So I wanted to ask you, you know, Marvel, 75 years old, what do you think their biggest contributions to the industry have been, you know, in the 75 years that they, like, what is their legacy?
You know, I don't know about the legacy of, you know, of the entire company. I look at Marvel, and for the most part, I see the legacy of Stan Lee and the Marvel Age of Comics. And I think what Stan brought was, you know, characters who act like people and have real people concerns. And, you know, I used to love, you know, especially the Thor comic books where you'd have, you know, a 20-page fight scene, all action story. And as, you know, people are throwing trucks at each other and, you know, ripping up city blocks and all that other stuff, they're also speaking philosophy. And I know that, you know, nowadays they say, oh, you know, it's unrealistic for people to talk in the middle of a fight. And I'm thinking, yeah, you've never been in Brooklyn. and, you know, I used to, you know, love that stuff. And I think that, you know, Stan brought a real human perspective to comic books, which, you know, dominated the industry for the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, into the 90s. And I think we're, you know, as time has gone on, we're kind of losing a lot of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, these days it's more of a, you know, a TV aspect to it, where you have people sitting around talking and you have headshots. If anything, you know, comic books are becoming more like radio, old radio dramas, where it's more dependent on the dialogue than the visuals, you know. And I think comic books should be visuals and dialogue together. But, you know, that could be old fashioned. What do you want? I'm an old fart.
Do you feel like that, that early Marvel magic has moved elsewhere, or do you think the company still maintains some of that?
I think the company maintains some of that, and certainly they have it in the movies. If you look at the Marvel movies, they have, you know, all of the hoo-ha that Stan injected into the comics. You know, some Marvel comics still have it, some don't.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, you know, you've worked with a lot of people while we're working with Marvel. What are some of the greatest creative talents that you've ever had the opportunity to work for or work with, either in your creator-writer phase or as your time as an editor or the editor-in-chief of Marvel?
That is... yeah, that is such a loaded question because, you know, I'm going to name, you know, a few dozen people and forget a couple of other dozen that I would go smack myself in the head for.
So why don't we forget about that question and we just I could just say, like, you know, do you have any, like, defining moments working with other people that during your time there at Marvel?
One of my defining moments is when I started to work with Ron Friends. I forget when Ron and I started working together, and I have yet to discover when Ron and I are going to stop working together. and I am, you know, thrilled by that relationship. I remember one time I did a plot for John Buscema. And I said to him, John, did you like the story? And his reaction was, it ain't Shakespeare, but I think I can save it. I loved working with Herb Trimpe. That Paul Ryan and, you know, well, yeah, I'm going to start getting into the names, you know, and writers, you know, Mark DeMattis and, you know, and I got to meet, you know, and you know, work with, you know, Roy Thomas and, you know, Jerry Conway, you know, guys that, you know, kind of helped build this industry. Barry Windsor Smith, you know, so many great people that, you know, I just feel like a goofy name dropper.
Okay. So let me ask you about your tenure as Marvel's editor-in-chief. Like, where do you feel like it falls into the greater history of the company, you know, if you had to speak about that?
The Forgotten Realms. Because I think that these days, you know, everybody forgets that I ever was, you know, Marvel editor-in-chief or anything.
But you were one of the longest lasting editors in Marvel's history, am I correct?
I think it was Stan, Shooter, Joe, and then me.
Yeah.
Or maybe Joe is longer than Shooter. I don't know. These days, I can't even get into most comic book conventions. So that's why I say Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, so, like, but personally to you, like, you know, are there achievements that you're very proud of during your time as editor-in-chief?
Well, you know, I was very happy with, you know, the Marvel Masterworks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, although, you know, at the time it was, you know, kind of a desperate move. You know, it's, the hassle is when I look back on my time as editor in chief, I remember more my failures than I do my successes.
I mean, you presided over a pretty tumultuous time there, and had to make several like big stands for your staff, if I'm correct.
Okay.
I don't know. I just finished reading that Marvel history book and reading about your time as editor. You know, it's like really fascinating to me.
Yeah, I got to read that book someday.
See how much of it is true.
Yeah, I was, you know, the author is a great guy. He sent me a copy. He's, you know, and I've heard very good things about the book, but, you know, part of me said, you know, if you read this, you know, really, it's either going to, you know, feed your ego and you know, I don't know if I need to have my ego fed, or it's going to piss me off. So I haven't gotten around to it yet.
Yeah.
I'm actually planning on taking my first vacation, probably since the 90s. Towards the end of October, and I'm going to take it with me.
Well, there you go.
So
let me ask you this then. Do you have any like favorite personal projects that you've worked on, like as a creator and or in any capacity, like something that like speaks to you personally?
Well, you know, Eric Masterson, he was kind of a synergy of me and Ron. So a lot of that was very personal.
Mm.
A lot of Spider-Girl was very personal. I based, you know, the character and her personality and a lot of her situation on one of my nieces and her relationship with her father. Who, you know, is no longer with us. But hold on a second. So a lot of that was personal. You know, a lot of the Spider-Man stuff was also very personal. You know, I'm a weird kind of writer. I once said to Mattis that I'm a one-note writer. And, you know, he said, what do you mean a one-note writer? And I said, I have to be, you know, all in, 100%. And he said to me, that's not what a one-note writer is. But, you know, I have to love my character and have to believe in the story in order for me to do it. And this doesn't matter whether or not it's a Spider-Man story or an Archie story, whatever kind of story. So, you know, to a certain extent, you know, they're all personal to me.
Do you have like a favorite, like story in the history of Marvel? I know that's a lot to pull from, but one that, you know, if I were to ask you that question, just jump straight to mind.
But by other people?
By anyone, yeah. What is Marvel's standout tale to you?
This Man, This Monster.
Mm.
It's a Fantastic Four issue.
That's the one where the Thing becomes human again? Is that the idea?
Yeah.
What about that one stands out to you as being like such a strong work?
Because it, you know, it's all about the, you know, it's all about, you know, who Ben Grimm is at his essence and his relationship with the Fantastic Four. And it just, you know, clearly delineates all of these characters. And, you know, to me, that's what, you know, that's what writing is all about. You know, I think that when I do a story, like I said, I have to put, you know, all of my passion into it. And my goal is kind of to reach out and, you know, touch the reader's heart. And if I succeed in doing that, you know, then, you know, to me, the story is priceless. And if I fail to do that, then the story is worthless. And you touch the reader's heart in different ways. You know, an Archie story touches the reader's heart in a different way from, you know, a Spider-Girl story does.
It was recently announced that you would be coming back to work on this Marvel 75th anniversary like comic that's being released in a couple weeks. But there are very little details about like what that is and what your role in it is. Could you speak to us about like what the project is?
The project is a 5-page Spider-Man story. Is it 5-page or 6-page? I think it's 5 pages. Yeah, I probably get in a lot of trouble telling you this, but I'm going to tell you anyway because it's between friends. So Tom Brevoort calls me up, and he says they want to do a 5-page Archie story, a 5-page Spider-Man story in this, for this 75th celebration thing, and they want Stan Goldberg to draw it. And because Stan had, colored a lot of the early Marvel stuff, mm-hmm. you know, Fantastic Four, the Hulk, Spider-Man, you know, all of that stuff. And Tom said to me, he says, I know you know Stan. When I thought of Stan, I just thought of you right away. And I said to Tom, yeah, get out of here. You're calling me because I'm the only guy you know who can write a 5-page story. and he said, well, yeah, that's kind of true, too. So my job was to write, you know, and they said to me, we want to do an Archie-style story. And I said, what do you mean an Archie-style Spider-Man story? Well, we want to set it during his time in college. And, have his friends around. So I said, okay. So, you know, here's what you get in 5 pages. You're going to get a real Spider-Man story with a beginning, middle, and end. It'll feature Peter's friends. It has a supervillain, has a fight scene, actually has a couple of fight scenes, has a menace to the city, and it's all resolved in 5 pages, and you know, it's a standalone story.
Sounds great. Sounds like something that has been sorely lacking in my life.
Well, you know, I'm sure people will look at it and say, "Oh man, this thing should have been, 50 pages." and it's 4 to 5 panels a page.
So good old efficient Marvel style.
Yeah, you know, storytelling, and this is important, no matter what kind of storytelling you're doing, you know, it has to be efficient. You have to get in, you have to get out, you have to make your case, you know, introduce your characters, you know, establish your status quo, you know, establish the conflict. Resolve the conflict, you know. You got to do that all with great efficiency.
I think people forget that Amazing Fantasy 15 was only 11 pages long.
Yeah. And, you know, the strange thing is that, you know, television, movies, these things are speeding up. Things are moving a lot faster than ever before. You know, when you do an hour television show, you know, with luck, you've got a script 44 pages long. You know, sometimes it's cut down to 42 or 40. And that's your entire shooting script. You gotta tell your story and tell it efficiently. Now, TV has an advantage because your intro credits, tend to introduce the characters. But you still gotta, move things along quickly. And, I always advise writers, tell your story. Don't tell people you're going to tell them a story. Tell them the story.
We've got this big Spider-Verse story coming up in the pages of Amazing Spider-Man that features all of the different Spider-Man incarnations over the past 50 years. And one of them in the next upcoming issues is Mayday Parker, Spider-Girl. And I was curious, if there was any connection between you and Dan Slott about the characterization of Mayday.
Dan and I haven't spoken, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah, I was just curious.
Yeah. Marvel at one point asked me about, doing a 10-page Mayday story connected to this. There's something called Spider-Verse Team-Up or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't, heard from them since they asked me. And, at the time they're ready to work on it, I'll see whether or not I have time.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the life of a freelancer is dictated by his calendar.
So it's 2014, and we live in a world where Peter David is now writing Spider-Man 2099 again, and Rick Leonardi is back to provide art for a few issues. You said you're done writing Spider-Man. I mean, not you're done, but you're not like dying to do it. Would you have any interest in returning to Mayday Parker with Ron to continue that series if the possibility arose?
Oh yeah, if the possibility arose, I'd jump at the chance to work with Ron on, on Spider-Girl again. Here's a secret thing that, since I'm sure no editors are listening to this, I can say, basically, if you have Ron, I'm more than happy to come along for the ride, whatever the assignment is. Because I just love working with Ron so much. And I should never say that out loud because it always destroys my negotiating position.
Yeah, we love Ron. He's been on the show like 4 or 5 times now. And, I can see exactly what you mean. Just the easiest guy to work with.
He is a dream to work with. And, he and I have worked together, for so many years, and we work together so well. We both have the same attitude, which is the story is the most important thing. And I use this expression that Ron and I are idea factories. So sometimes I come up with a couple of ideas and I, mention them to Ron, and then Ron comes up with other ideas, and then I react to those ideas with other ideas, and blah, 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 blah. And then by the time we're done, we have a story, but I can't separate the ideas. and nor do I care whether or not we separate the ideas. I just think, hey, we have a story. I'm thankful for that.
Just true collaboration.
Yeah, because, in the creative field, there should be no ego. The ego should be for the story, not for the not for my ideas or that sort of stuff. Anytime I deal with a creative people who are jealous and protective of their ideas, I just want to smack them and, send them into a corner, make them sit in a corner.
So this week there was a comic released where Gwen Stacy took up the mantle of Spider-Man in this kind of alternate universe where she got bit by the spider instead. You know, this kind of Spider Girl concept seems to be this, like, eternal spring. And there's a lot of hype around this title becoming an ongoing series. So, you know, there have been a lot of, you know, other Spider-Man characters that are invented in their own universes. But what kind of advice would you give someone creating their own Spider-Man alternate universe tale that kept your series going for so long? Like, what was the spice that made... Because, you know, as to this day, Spider-Girl is the longest-lasting female-led title in Marvel's history. Like, what do you think was the magic there?
A female superhero, because yes. I think Millie the model and what was the other character? There was another character that lasted, you know, 200 issues or something like that. Anyway, I would tell them to do what we did in Spider-Girl, which is, you know, build an entire world, you know, around her and, you know, give her a supporting cast, give her, you know, a status quo that you actually keep for a couple of years. Again, build the world. You know, everybody talks about world building, but they, you know, nobody actually builds worlds anymore. They just, you know, bring in the character, and then, you know, 3 months into it, things will never be the same again because we're going to upset the apple cart. And 2 issues later, oh, we're going to upset the apple cart again. But you got to have time to stack the apples so that people realize, you know, that there are apples stacked in a cart before you can, you know, upend it.
Is this how you feel about, like, the event that Marvel does, like, every year?
Well, to be honest, I haven't been paying attention to those events, so I don't really have an opinion about them.
Yeah.
I think it's very important to, you know... really establish a status quo before you can upset the status quo. You know?
Yeah.
You have, if you don't know what the world is and the relationships, it's hard to upset that world and the relationships. You know, that's why, you know, if you have a television series that's going to run... let's say you get 22 episodes, you know, you spend, you know, the first, you know, 10 episodes, which, you know, would be close to a year in a comic book, setting up the status quo. And you don't really upset the status quo until, you know, the final cliffhanger of the season. And sometimes even then you don't upset the status quo. And that would be the second year into a comic book. Mm-hmm. But these days, you know, by the fifth issue, you're upsetting the status quo. And, you know, most of the time that isn't even, you know, one complete story anymore.
So if you could finish the sentence for me, finish the sentence for me. Marvel Comics is...
Marvel Comics... you know, Marvel Comics is... You know, I don't know what Marvel Comics is anymore. I'm not really up to date on what Marvel Comics... Marvel Comics is a mystery to me these days because I'm not really up to date on Marvel Comics and I'm not really paying all that much attention to Marvel Comics. But Marvel Comics, you know, was the greatest roller coaster ride of my life.
Great. Well, thanks, Tom, for joining us, and we hope to have you back again real soon.
Okay. Thank you, Dan.
Spider-Man and his amazing friends, Iceman and...
You can find all of our new Amazing Spider Talk and old Superior Spider Talk podcasts at SuperiorSpiderTalk.com. Or find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Amazing Spider Talk. And if you do, please make sure to leave a rating and comment to let us know what we're doing, and we'll read it on the air. If you have any opinions on these comics or any questions, make sure to email them to us at AmazingSpiderTalk@gmail.com, and we'll address and read them on the air. Also, be sure to check out both of our Facebook pages at Facebook.com/SuperiorSpiderTalk and Facebook.com/ChasingAmazing, because they're great places to keep up with us in between shows, as we often put up articles that we've written and other breaking news about the Spider-Man universe and how to get in touch with us. Don't forget to check out the Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Talk Members Club that helps us support the show. Of course, you can follow me, Dan Gavazdin, at Dan Gavazdin on Twitter, and my Spider-Man work at @SupSpiderTalk and at SuperiorSpiderTalk.com. Now, before I go, I want to remind you all of the eternal words of Mark Giannacchio: with great podcasts must also come amazing spider talk. Man, it's weird to say that.
Spider-Man and his amazing friends.